Welcome, everybody. This is the office hours session, the fourth one for the Mises Academy online class, Economics of the Great Depression. Today is December 8th, 2012. And due to my fault, we're getting a late start, so this will be a session that's only two-thirds as long as normal, but let's jump right into it. If any of you guys have questions, while you guys are thinking, let me maybe just elaborate a little bit on something I was saying in the last class, because I kind of rushed through it. But if we're trying to understand why was unemployment so high during the 1930s, and why did it stay so persistently high for so long, in one sense, the fundamental reason is, well, because wages were too high, or you can say real wages, right? So, employers are not going to hire somebody unless the revenue the employer is going to get, the additional revenue, the marginal revenue, as an economist would say, from hiring that extra worker and having him work on stuff, and so they produce more output. The marginal revenue has to be higher than the wages paid to that worker. And if that's the case, then it makes sense, right? Your total profit goes up by hiring the worker. If that's not true, if the amount of additional revenue you're going to get from hiring that worker and incorporating him into your production process is not higher than the amount you have to pay him to get him to come work for you, well, then your profits go down by hiring him. So why would you do that? So when the bust occurs, and entrepreneurs, from an Austrian perspective, realize, oh, shoot, we've been engaged in long-term production processes that actually we shouldn't have ever gotten into. And so people realize this now that, oh, we were making a terrible mistake. One way that manifests itself is they realize these workers aren't as productive as we thought they were last week when the boom was still going. Okay, so that's one way of thinking about the sudden shock of when the boom turns into a bust, is that a lot of the entrepreneurs who had these big projects going and had hundreds of workers under their belt realize, ooh, I shouldn't have started this. And what that means is the amount I've been paying these workers, thinking about all these big profits I'm going to, revenues I'm going to get, I made a mistake. I'm not going to get those big revenues from this project, meaning these workers weren't as productive as I thought they were. Because it's not an issue of their physical productivity. It's not an issue of, The mistake during the boom period was not a mistake of engineering or of physics or of chemistry. It wasn't that you hired a bunch of workers thinking they were going to be able to produce 1,000 cars that looked a certain way and had certain engineering characteristics, and then you realize 3 years into the boom, oh, wait a minute, these cars actually can only go 0 to 80 in, whatever, 12 seconds, not in the 8 seconds that I thought. Shoot. And do you think those numbers are really high? I'm saying because they're building cars back in the 1920s, the cars probably, they can go 0 to 10 in 2 minutes. All right, so that's not what happens. What happens is economically they realize they made a mistake. That in particular, two things. One is, oh, the costs or the monetary expenses of running this operation are getting to be higher and higher than I thought they would be back when I started making fixed investments that are now sunk costs. Right, so what I have to pay for electricity, what I have to pay for manual labor, what I have to pay, whatever, for the rubber and steel that I'm using to make these cars or whatever it is, the glass, those prices are rising more quickly as this boom drags on and on than I thought they were back when I started laying the foundation for this new factory. I may not have gone down this path had I realized that. So that's one thing. And then the other is, oh, I thought that consumers were going to keep increasing their spending on vehicles by 13% per year, because that's what they were doing early on in the boom, but now the consumers are getting over indebted and so forth, and they're cutting back, or especially if interest rates go up, now all of a sudden consumers aren't willing to buy cars because I'm giving these low APRs, the financing and everything, and all of a sudden the demand for my finished Ferraris just fell off a cliff, or my Model Ts, whatever. All right, so so that's what happens. So you think about it that way. There's a sense in which, in terms of their marginal revenue product, if you're familiar with that term from economics, the employers realize the workers are not as valuable as they thought they were. So in a sense, their productivity goes down. Again, not because there's a change in the law of physics, or rather, not even because the employers incorrectly or base their plans on faulty engineering principles or faulty physics. That's not what I mean when I say all of a sudden the productivity of labor dropped from 1929 to 1930. What I mean is the employer's expectations about the physical things their workers could do, what that would be worth in the marketplace when they went to go sell it, that changed dramatically from 1929 to 1930 and kept plummeting, right? Because as prices kept falling, including the prices of the finished products that employers are selling, then the amount that it made sense to pay workers to produce those things kept going down. And so in that environment, if nominal wages are sticky, so meaning either they don't go down at all, or they just, it's very, there's a lot of friction, that it's hard to get workers to accept cuts in the absolute number of dollar bills they get paid each paycheck, then that's a bad combination. So that was the situation, and we can talk about, as free market economists, or as Rothbardians, I guess, more specifically, why was there this apparent so-called wage stickiness in the 1930s when that wasn't the case in 1920-21? Because remember back then, I explained to you guys, prices fell more over a 12-month span than in any 12-month period during the Great Depression. Now, the total drop in prices was bigger during the 30s than back in 1920-21 just because they kept falling in the 30s. 1920-21, they fell very rapidly. The economy bottomed out, and then prices started rising again. Whereas in the 30s, prices fell steeply, but not nearly as steeply as back in 20 and 21, but the fall just kept happening and happening and happening from 29 to 33. And so that's why the total drop in percentage terms of prices, consumer prices, was bigger, but like I said, over any 12-month span. And so that's my argument there was, it's hard to say the reason the 30s were so awful is because of falling prices, because it was steeper back from 1920 to 21. So you'd think in 1921, the economy should have been worse than the economy was in 1930 or 1931, because at that equivalent point in 21, prices had fallen more rapidly from the peak to the trough than at that similar point in the Depression. But yet in the Depression, things just kept unraveling, whereas in 2021, they turned around. So why the difference? Right, so that's the argument. And then when you get that under your belt, then the point is, so in that environment, I would argue there's lots of ways we can explain why wages were stickier during the 30s, not the least of which is that both presidents had their active agenda to keep wages from falling. And so then the issue was just to go in and investigate and see what could they have done. So with FDR, it's crystal clear the sorts of things he did to prop wages up, at least in certain sectors. Whereas with Hoover, it's a little bit trickier. So this is more detailed than you need to know for this course, and I just want to make sure you understand the big picture, that there's no doubt whatsoever that wages fell more sluggishly, nominal wages, meaning the actual absolute dollar amounts in people's paychecks. They fell more slowly after 1929 than they had from 1920 to 21. They fell very rapidly from 20 to 21. And so there's no dispute about the fact of what we're calling wage rigidity. And then the issue is just what caused it. And to the extent that it was government intervention, clearly the free market should be exonerated from the catastrophe of the Great Depression, when the boom and bust were not the fault of the free market, if you're an Austrian. And then even the agony of the recovery was not the fault of the free market. It was the fault of the government trying to prop up wages. So last point, and then I'll turn to your guys' questions here. What do we know for sure about what the New Deal propped up wages? What's the mechanism by which the federal government propped wages up? Well, there's many of them. but one in particular was what we talked about at the tail end of lecture four, and that was the work of those UCLA economists that was summarized in the op-ed I gave you. And then, like I said, if you're really a geek, you can go Google their academic papers on which that op-ed was based. And they said that various New Deal programs, in particular the NIRA, the way that worked is they formed cartels among the major industries. Over 500 plus sectors were involved. And so the federal government would basically anoint the leading firms in each of these selected industries and tell them, you guys write up a code of fair competition for your industry. And then we, the federal government, will crack down and knock heads, you know, literally fine people or put them in jail if they violate the code that you guys write up. But for us to sign off, us, the federal government, to sign off on the code you come up with, we want you also, as part of, you know, fair competition, to pay your workers, you know, an honest wage or a fair wage or a decent wage or whatever. I don't know what the terminology they used was, but that was part of the code. So what happened is the dominant industries or dominant firms in each industry, one of the things to make it fair was, oh, well, we can't be undercutting each other. That's just a cutthroat competition that will be a spiral to the bottom, and we can't do that because we all know that's just, you know, that's a shooting all of each other in the foot. And we also have to pay our workers a lot because they have to go buy the product from us. And so what it did was it raised prices. It put a floor under the actual retail prices for consumers, and that helped dominant firms. So that's why they were all in favor of this. And it screwed over the little mom-and-pop enterprises within that industry because that was the only way they could compete, was by charging lower prices than the industry leaders did. So those people are all in trouble. And then the workers who are fortunate enough to be in the big bit, the dominant firms in a given industry, they all have nice wage floors. And so the empirical work of these two economists who wrote that op-ed that I assigned to you guys, it was pretty neat what they did. The way they tried to figure out, and they came with those statistics saying like manufacturing wages were 25% higher because of these interventions from the federal government. And the way they got that number, like I told you, is it's not merely that they looked at when the legislation went into place and then looked at what happened to wages afterward and then just said, well, that must have caused it. It was more sophisticated. Because you could just say, well, maybe the economy recovered because the New Deal was awesome and that's why wages went up. And so that wouldn't prove that the New Deal was a bad thing. That artificially raised wages. What they did was there were some what economists might call natural experiments, where because of quirks, like court rulings or just the wording of the actual statute in the new part as part of the New Deal, the act giving the government the authority to do these things and to form these cartels, because of the wording of that statute, for some reason, some sectors were covered and the law was applicable to them, and other sectors weren't. And so the ones that weren't covered, the big firms in that industry couldn't legally set up one of these codes of fair competition, so the government couldn't legally crack down on their competitors for undercharging them or for paying their workers less than what the code would have demanded they get paid. And so you had side-by-side industries that were very similar, you know, mining coal of one type versus coal of a different type, but in the same geographical region and stuff, like drawing from the same pools of labor and that kind of stuff. So they were very similar in all respects, except this law, this cartelization device, was applicable to one but not the other. And so then the economists looked at the wage rates in those two areas over time and saw that they ended up, you know, as time dragged on, the gap between what workers were getting paid in absolute dollar terms in one industry was kept getting bigger and bigger compared to the other one. And so that's where they're coming up with these numbers saying this act by the government raised wages, propped wages up, made them higher than otherwise would be. So if you're trying to understand how come the labor market just wasn't clearing for a decade, well, if you're not letting wages fall, duh, what do you think's going to happen? Okay, let me turn your guys' questions now. Susan says, here's a very general one that occurred to me during class four. Why don't people talk about how good Austrian economic theory is, or do they? It is always having to be defended that Federal Reserve is considered a good, necessary thing, a given. Well, I don't know if you mean people, if you mean like we Austrians, like how come we're always attacking the mainstream instead of us just praising ourselves and saying how great our alternative is? Well, let me come back to that. Let me take the other possible interpretation. But if you mean how come the average economist doesn't talk about how great Austrian economics is because they think Austrian economics is stupid, so that's why they don't praise us. If you mean us, you know, being in a small minority, how come we spend so much of our time dealing with Keynes? You know, people ask me, Bob, why are you so obsessed with Paul Krugman and that kind of stuff? And, you know, my glib answer is, well, because he won the Nobel Prize and he's got this perch at the New York Times that's probably arguably the biggest economics blog in the world. And he's beating the drums all the time for deficit spending and so forth and government intervention, hiking tax rates on rich people. So, you know, that's why I focus on him a lot. And he's, and also because he's a sharp guy and I think he makes the best case for Keynesian policies. So if I'm going to, you know, it would be silly for me to take on some journalist who's advocating bigger deficits because that guy is just distilling what Krugman said. Krugman refers to academic peer-reviewed models and stuff like that. So that's why I focus on Krugman myself. And as far as Austrians in general, the reason a lot of times, like if you go to Mises University or something, it's true, we spend more time dealing with things we don't agree with than some other school. Like, you know, if you go and just take economics from Greg Mankiw at Harvard, he's probably just going to get there and teach it and say, this is what economics is, end of story. But that's because he's in the dominant mainstream orthodoxy. So if we're a minority group that thinks the mainstream orthodoxy is totally wrong, and here's why, you know, it, other things equal, why would anyone listen to us? You know, you guys are the punk little group that's out of Auburn, Alabama, or that's where you're teaching this Mises University, and all these other people are at the prestigious universities, MIT, Harvard. They're the ones winning Nobel Prizes. They have, you know, the government consults with them. They're the ones running the Federal Reserve. You guys seem like you're just a bunch of cranks. So to convince Joe Blow that, well, no, you really should listen to us because we know what's going on, we have to show why the mainstream is wrong and why our ideas are better. So I don't know if that is answering your question or not. And also there's, Susan, a more cynical explanation in terms of when you say, why is it that it seems like the press and all the punditry and the institutions of major media seem to be pro-Keynesian and anti-Austrian? Well, I think part of it is just the Keynesians are in the dominant mainstream right now, so the average person is just going to think that's normal because that's what he hears growing up. But also, someone could be cynical and say it's not a coincidence because Keynesianism, whether it's right or wrong in an academic sense, clearly is good for people who want to expand state power. And so if you at all subscribe to a view of the world that says there are powerful people who like to use the state to further their own wealth and so forth and influence, they're not going to be given endowments to Harvard to hire a bunch of Austrian economists. You know, if you're a rich industrialist who's not afraid to turn to the state for favors and to knock out your competitors, you're probably not going to lobby and try to pull strings to get Joe Salerno to be the next Federal Reserve chairman. Why would you do that? That would be stupid. You want somebody at the Fed who is willing to bail out investment bankers if you guys get into trouble. And so somebody like Ben Bernanke is perfect. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question. Okay, George says, I missed last night's lecture. As I recall from Friedman and Schwartz, many people were anticipating gold confiscation if when Roosevelt were elected, so they took measures to protect their holdings. Yet Fort Knox was built to house the amount confiscated, suggesting a big haul for the government. Were only a relatively few people actually successful in protecting their gold? Okay, that's a good question, George. I mean, they certainly, you can go look at Wikipedia and look at Fort Knox and the gold depository, or go Google gold confiscation 1933, and you can see, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but there was a tremendous amount of gold they seized. I think it was something like, I saw a figure, and I have it in my depression, but like how many statues of liberty they could build out of solid gold or something like that, the amount of gold they seized. I don't remember the number was. Right, but it was a fantastic sum that they took in. but I don't know what the percentage was. Like, I don't know how many Americans, what they did with it. And I certainly agree with you that, yeah, they could have done things like ship them offshore to some other place that would hold them. I'm sure a lot of wealthy people did that sort of thing. But, you know, it's also, it would be, like, they would have to permanently keep it offshore, you know what I mean? It's not like if there was 2 years later the thing was repealed and they could get their gold from the guy holding it in Mexico or something, or Canada, and then they could get it back. So it was a pretty sweeping move. And then I did explain this in the lecture, George, and you probably know this since it seems like you're into the gold stuff. But it wasn't just that they said it's a crime for you to actually possess gold. They actually outlawed gold clauses, meaning you can't even write contracts that make the dollar payment owed based on whatever the spot price of gold is when the payment has to occur. So they couldn't even simulate contracts based on gold that way, even though the gold technically would be outside the jurisdiction of the United States. So, I mean, they really did what they could to totally sever people's mental link to gold as being the underlying money, and to get people to start thinking of the dollar as the end all and be all, and it is the U.S. dollar that is the money in this economy, not gold. There were some interesting court cases. I mean, people didn't just roll over and take this. There were wealthy guys that refused to turn in their gold, or they did turn it in, but they filed a lawsuit trying to get it back. And so there are some cases like that. I think some of them even won. I mean, I didn't follow that stuff completely. I just came across those things when I was doing research for the book. But I mean, it's kind of like you read stories now about how if you conduct your affairs a certain way, you might not have to have a driver's license. And yeah, you get arrested all the time, but then the cops have to let you go. And if you never send in your income tax statement, then technically, you know, somebody could argue that the income tax amendment doesn't apply to you, and therefore you don't owe income. Stuff like that, where conceivably there were some loopholes in the Act of 1933, such that if you structured your affairs a certain way, I mean, one thing you could do is you could have just a bunch of antique, you know, numismatic gold coins, or you know, gold coins that were valued for numismatic reasons, that, you know, they had nice engravings and they were from the Spanish Empire or something. So you could do things like that, because those were exempted, because they didn't want to just take special gold coins from coin dealers that had a much higher price than just the market, or the, you know, the gold content at the market price of gold, and just give them $20.67 per ounce. Like, even the FDR administration wasn't that totalitarian. So I suppose some people could have protected themselves that way, and they could have just stocked up on all these antique gold coins. No, I'm just a collector. It's not that I'm using the gold as money. Okay. Susan says, when Hoover increased spending, where did the money come from? It wasn't being printed at that time, so was it borrowed? Well, there's two ways of looking at that, Susan. It's, on the one hand, the federal government per se, the way it's structured, doesn't just run the printing press the way like a stereotypical banana republic might, all right, or like a Caesar or something doesn't just take in taxes and coins that have gold content and then melt all the coins down and then add in some base metal and then recoin more coins and then spend that in the classic, you know, government action of debasing the currency. So what happens under modern nation states with a central bank is more subtle. And if you're interested, you can go look at my Mises.org article called something like "The Fed is Legal Counterfeiter," or something like that. That might not be the exact wording, but if you just Google Robert Murphy Fed counterfeiter. You'll probably get it. It's a Mises.org article from a couple of years ago. And I walked you through the mechanics if you're interested. But basically, my point is your question's not, you can't neatly distinguish the two. Like World War I is a really good example. If you go look at what happened with the government's budgets and with the Federal Reserve, you can see that government deficits were huge during World War I, and so the absolute government debt went way up. But at the same time, if you look at a chart of the monetary base, that went way up also. And if you look at CPI, you'll see there was at one point like 20% year-over-year price inflation measured in terms of the rise in official consumer prices. So if you say during World War I, how did the U.S. government pay for the military expenditures? Did it borrow the money or did the Fed print it? It's actually both, because what happened is, strictly speaking, the federal government can't just have the Fed print up money and give it to it for nothing. What happens is the federal government runs a budget deficit, so they spend more than they take in tax revenue, and then they issue bonds to borrow the difference, just like any corporation would. But then the Fed's over here in the corner printing money to buy up government bonds. So it's a smoke and mirrors game. And then the thing that's even crazier is the interest payments that the Treasury has to make on bonds that are held by the Fed come right back to the government. Because the Fed, when it's running its affairs, it typically earns a profit, right? Because they can create money out of thin air and then go buy interest-earning assets with it. So that's it'd be hard to lose money if you're running the Fed. And then, but once they pay their bills and whatever, the excess earnings they have, they remit to the government, and that's called seniorage. So effectively, the Fed creates money out of thin air to buy the bonds that the government creates. So it's like the Fed lending money to the government at 0% interest. Okay, oh, George P.S. The Fed is giant counterfeiter, thanks. So with Hoover, it's the same thing. I mean, if you look at the monetary base and whatever, it's, well, you know, actually it did decrease a little bit. And then, you know, I showed you the chart that's in Lecture 4. You can look at the monetary base. You can't say definitively one way or another what did the Fed do with the base from 1929 onward, because at one point it's kind of gently falling and then it starts rising rapidly, so it's, and then it totally spiked in 33. So it's hard to say exactly, but you're right, the Fed couldn't monetize the debt as easily under the classical gold standard as it would be able to once we had just fiat money. So that's true. But either way, strictly speaking, the federal government to run a deficit borrows it. It's just to the extent that the Fed is the one soaking up that new debt, you could argue, well, it's not borrowing it from the rest of the world, it's just borrowing it from the printing press. Just like, for example, in 2011, last year, the Fed increased its holdings of treasuries by an amount equal to 77% of what the federal government borrowed that year. So some have argued the Fed effectively monetized 77% of the deficit in 2011. So if that number happened to be 100%, then it would be a plausible thing to say the federal government took in a certain amount in tax revenue and the rest that it spent, the Fed just ran off on the printing press. I mean, that is a shell game. That's effectively what would happen if that number happened to be 100%. It wasn't 100%, but it was 77% in 2011. Okay, let's see. Bob Trumbo says, what is your opinion of Amity Slade's book, The Forgotten Man? I didn't read the whole thing. I got it specifically for a certain chapters on the New Deal. Well, I mean, that's kind of a duh. That's what the book is about, but meaning the butchers in New York, and there are certain particular cases where I read it very carefully just for to get the actual chronology and to get some of the color of what happened and some of the more famous New Deal court cases and so on. So I didn't read the thing cover to cover, so I can't say if on the whole I liked what her thesis was. Certainly, I like the theme of it, the forgotten man, you know, being the little guy that's getting screwed over by these government policies. What I don't know off the top of my head is if she buys into Milton Friedman's theory of what caused the crash. And that's the only thing that gives me pause. A lot of the research I was doing, obviously there's a bunch of right-wing conservative free market perspectives out there that hate the New Deal, but a lot of them endorse Milton Friedman's explanation for why the Depression happened in the first place. And so, from a Rothbardian point of view, I would say, well, I don't agree with that. Okay, let's see. Susan said, so if it weren't for NIRA, prices would have fallen even more during the 30s. If they had left it alone, perhaps prices would have fallen more like they did in 1920-21. Well, yeah, that's probably true. But the important thing for the NIRA is that it's not so much the consumer prices, it's the wage rates. And so that's really the important thing, that it was propping up wage rates. Because the issue with you hiring somebody is not so much what's the absolute wage. The question is what's the absolute wage compared to the absolute revenue that you're getting or the price of the product. So it's okay if prices are falling so long as wages can fall too. Okay, Daniel Richardson says, please elaborate on the federal agents who oversaw the destruction of crops and the increase of government employees to oversee this and other regulations enacted under Hoover and Roosevelt. Well, Daniel, I'm not sure what you want. I mean, I'm off the top of my head, I can't tell you statistics like to say, oh, the employment of bureaucrats went up by 13% in 1934. There are figures like that in my book, but off the top of my head, I can't tell you that kind of stuff. What I can say is that under both Herbert Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt, it was an official policy of the federal government to raise agricultural prices. And so Rothbard in particular goes through, so you can, if you're interested, and need to look the specifics of it and the chronology, go read Rothbard. You know, I've assigned the relevant portions where you can see, is it true? Yeah, I think it's in there. You know, I said, you know, read this, this, and this, and if you have a lot of time, keep reading it. So in there, you can go just flip through and you can see when he starts talking about it. But what the Hoover administration tried for a while was using federal money to buy agricultural items and that way try to prop up their price. And then the problem with that is, though, that just induced more people to get into that sector. And so if the problem was, oh, the farmers aren't able to earn enough from selling wheat in order to pay the mortgage or the mortgage payment to the bank because wheat prices have fallen, and the federal government comes and says, oh, well, we'll start buying wheat. That should help the wheat farmers earn more money. But now farmers just start planting more wheat because, oh, now the federal government's buying it. That doesn't help. That doesn't solve the problem. Now it's just the taxpayers are losing money, and the government starts filling up silos with excess wheat. And meanwhile, people are starving, and the farmers are still having difficulty making ends meet because the actual price didn't go up that much, because now the supply went up too. So yeah, the government increased the demand for wheat, but then the supply shifted also. So that was a problem. And then it was just introducing more volatility where the silos would be filling up with wheat, and then the government would say, well, we don't want to just let it rot, so let's sell it. And then that would crush the price when they did that kind of stuff. So they realized the only long-term solution to this is to permanently raise agricultural prices and to get us out of this crazy cycle where we just keep accumulating and then dump it on the market is if we pay farmers to produce less. And so then there's funny anecdotes about, and it was some of this was in the Larry Reed piece. I don't know if you read that, Daniel, the one that was assigned. If you go look at that stuff, there's some funny anecdotes, and I know you have my book, and there's some other stuff in there too about you know, how did they actually do this? Like, they had to go make sure. In other words, they didn't want to just take the farmer's word for it. And he said, oh, yeah, I destroyed all my crops. Like, they would have to send out agents to make sure that the farmers were actually plowing under, you know, I don't know that much about agriculture, so I don't really know much more than to say plowing under means they dragged the plows the wrong way and turned over the soil and messed it up so that that harvest, they wouldn't be able to get the tobacco or wheat or whatever it was they were growing there. I mean, that's the limit of my knowledge of farming. But the point is, the animals had been trained to pull the plow in a certain way to not screw it up, obviously. And then the federal regulators are sitting there telling the farmers, oh, you got to plow under the fields, and the animals didn't want to. And so then there was a joke that, and I don't know if this actually happened, but it was a joke that, you know, the regulators sitting there trying to convince the ox or whatever, or the mule, sorry, to do the wrong thing in terms of what you need if you want to grow more food. And so the idea was that the ass knew more about economics than the government agent. Another thing, too, is there was, and it's in the Larry Reed piece, with these codes of industry and so on, I mean, they would do things like prohibiting night work. Like, that was one way to limit production and to raise prices. So these big firms that wrote the codes of fair competition, they would insist on a minimum price, insist on paying workers, you know, a fair wage, that kind of stuff. And then another thing they would do is they would limit the amount of hours. So they might say, oh, and you can't work on Saturdays after 6 p.m. and you have to be closed on Sunday. And so that was just more ways that they were preventing mom and pops from competing against them and to just maintain, you know, their dominance. So what would happen is there'd be like mom and pop tailors who would be sewing pants when it was illegal to be sewing pants. And agents would literally break down their doors with axes and come in and grab them and say, what are you doing? You can't be sewing pants at Saturday at 7 o'clock at night, and that's a crime. So, I mean, when they enforced these things, it wasn't, I mean, it was draconian. They actually had some guys around, agents, kicking in doors to catch people doing stuff that was illegal. That was the way they enforced these codes. So it wasn't just a, oh, turn on the radio and FDR is giving us a fireside chat, the economy's fixed, yay. No, I mean, when they're outlawing practices that used to occur, how do you get people to comply? You got to fine them and catch them in the act and use physical force. Okay, let me just answer one more question. Daniel, you're talking about, yeah, you were interested in that stuff. So, yeah, the only thing I have to tell you is, I mean, you can go read more, like John Flynn's The Roosevelt Myth had some of that stuff. I think John Flynn was the guy that actually wrote the passage that Larry Reed quoted and then I reproduced in my book about federal agents kicking in doors and breaking down doors with axes and taking people out and lining them up. They didn't shoot them. When I say they lined them up, they didn't shoot them, but they lined them up. And so they would raid a place. I mean, it was like nowadays if there's a raid on a drug house where they think somebody's selling cocaine or selling meth or something, and the, you know, the SWAT teams or wherever, and the DEA goes in and breaks your door and scares the crap out of everyone in the middle of the night. That's what they would do to tailors, the guys who are sewing pants, because those guys would be, oh, they'd have to be quiet about it because they knew I'm not legally supposed to be working past this time or on the weekend or whatever. And so the government would have to catch you in the act. So they'd have to, you know, they couldn't just knock on your door and wait for you to open the door because then you would put all the stuff away and make it look like you were just reading a book. They had to burst into your place and catch you in the act. Okay, last thing, Susan says, but back in that period, we were on the gold standard, so could the Fed still print extra dollars? Yeah, they could. That's one thing I just want to be clear with you guys. Even under the classical gold standard, it wasn't 100% gold-backed dollars, all right? There was what was called the gold cover ratio, and that wasn't 100%. So there still was some discretion. Central banks could and did, even when they were still redeeming in specie at the official rate, they had a margin for error. They could print more. It's just if they got too aggressive, then the gold would start flowing, you know, leaving their vaults, and then they would have to cut back. But certainly they had some leeway where they could print more for a bit. Okay. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Again, I apologize for that late start, and I will put up quiz 4 early next week.